Good evening, folks, and welcome back. I'm your host, Mark Call. And how do we start to wrap up a week where, once again, we saw that if their lips are moving, they're lying? And when it comes to deceptions, cover-ups, yes, racketeering, and even outright treason, there's an increasingly obvious reason that the fake news organizations that make up the Ministry of Truth are really anxious to shut down the web and any alternatives to truth as they want to ram it down our throats. So let's start there, because it's a great way to make sure all the other pieces fit together. This is a piece from Russia Today. Sometimes I have to go to the lesser communist to find out what the ones in the United States are up to. It's entitled Facebook. And that's not spelled the way you've probably seen it spelled. It's F-A-C-E-S-P-O-O-K, and it's probably a lot more apropos. Social media giant, and we know who we're talking about, has become an arm of U.S. Intel. Surprise, surprise. Says Finian Cunningham, Facebook, the world's top social media platform, is reportedly seeking to hire hundreds of employees with U.S. national security clearances. Allegedly, it's for the aim of weeding out fake news and, of course, the dreaded foreign meddling in elections. Deep state meddling is clearly okay. And if this plan, reported actually by Bloomberg, sounds sinister, well, and I can't help but agree, that's because it is. Because it means that people who, by definition, share the same worldview as the deep state and its U.S. intelligence agencies, agencies who formulate classified information, and let's not forget, when it comes to dealing with that, some people are obviously more equal than others. Well, those agencies will have a direct bearing on what millions of consumers on Facebook are permitted to see. It is as close to outright government censorship on the Internet as we have yet, at least, dared to imagine. On the place where friends meet. As Bloomberg reports it, workers with such clearances, national security clearances, can access information classified by the U.S. government. Facebook plans to use these people and their ability to receive government information about potential threats in the company's attempt to search more proactively, meaning don't search at all if something is verboten, for questionable social media campaigns ahead of election. A Facebook spokesman declined to comment, but the report does sound credible, especially in the current U.S. fake media context. Facebook and other U.S. Internet companies, writes the author, have been hauled in front of congressional committees to declare what they know about the alleged Russian influence campaigns. Up until very recently, they were not asked what they knew about Uranium One and the graft, corruption, and racketeering of the Clinton Foundation and Clinton campaign. Mark Zuckerberg, CEO of Facebook, initially rebuffed claims that his company had unwittingly assisted Russian interference in the U.S. last November. Now, given the politics, says Finian Cunningham, Zuckerberg and the other social media giants are clearly buckling. Sounds like somebody made them an offer they couldn't refuse. Bottom line, Facebook and other big U.S. Internet companies are now directing users to what they call authoritative news organizations. You know what that means. They have official Big Brother approval, and we're rapidly getting to the point where, if they don't, you won't hear it. Case in point, and there were a couple that happened late Thursday into Friday. But prior to that, we heard via multiple witnesses multiple stories of multiple shooters, not including Stephen Patsy on the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay. And no, we didn't hear about it via the fake news waste stream. And the same goes for the shooter and the witnesses at the Bellagio. And there's more. Rick Wiles' people at True News, including Edward Zoll, did most of the legwork on this story. While gunshots were still being fired on the assembled crowd at the killing fields there in Las Vegas, a seven-man team, led by an FBI agent, who better, tactically and expeditiously moved through the casino area of the Tropicana Hotel towards the hotel's primary security office. Their mission, according to a senior official, no, not to stop the executions, not to apprehend suspects, was to secure the video footage being captured from the Tropicana south-facing external surveillance cameras, which were recording an unparalleled high-resolution view of the massacre from beginning to end. But the story here really is location, location, location. Because the Tropicana Hotel is literally on the opposite side of the venue from the Mandalay Bay, just over 2,000 feet from that infamous 32nd floor, and under 1,000 feet from Concert Central, where the majority of the victims were shot. Cameras near the top of the Tropicana southernmost tower would have had an unobstructed view of Stephen Patsy Paddock's room while, or if, he was firing on the crowd. Furthermore, they would have had a view of the entire venue and any other shooters as well. Notice that we're coming up on 3 weeks now. You haven't seen those videos. Hint, hint, I don't think you're gonna. And up until revelations like this one, you weren't even told they existed. I'm sure there's a reason for that. Edward Zoll reported that he had talked with the Las Vegas MPD spokesman, who told him that the Vegas PD and their investigation had no video of the alleged shooter, Stephen Patsy Paddock, whatsoever. Which is part of the reason your host continues to suggest that perhaps FBI now properly stands for Fully Blocked Investigation. And as if all of that wasn't bad enough, earlier in the week we had additional stinky smells arising from the implosion and decomposition of the official narrative. Remember Jesus Campos, who mysteriously disappeared for several days from doing serious interviews for at least a few real journalists? Well, he reappeared, as you may have heard, and was on, yes, that paragon of investigative journalism, Ellen DeGeneres, where the word softball doesn't really quite tell the whole story. But it does tell the end of the story, it would seem. I'll introduce it this way. We have an area out by the garden where we throw kitchen scraps to make compost. And now, we've given it a name. You can guess. It's now the Jesus Compost. Well, the insightful interview on Ellen is now history. And Compost did say, in response to penetrating questions, that he was, quote, doing better each day, slowly but surely. And he confirmed that he had called in when he was shot before the full rampage began. He wasn't asked, and evidently was appropriately coached, about the official timeline. It does seem like the official timeline narrative is fixing to be revised one more time, too. And if video of the FBI stealing video continues to come out, they'd better hurry. There was some other, information that provided more obfuscation than illumination about the door and what was wrong. Of particular interest, but not explored, is how he managed to survive those 200 rounds fired down the hallway, and where he was and where the other guy was, really, when all this happened. We could ask, where's the brass on that score, too? But at least 200 rounds is a lot closer to what may have been seen there in the official and pretty much only crime scene photos we're allowed to see than multiple thousands. Maybe the biggest revelation, if you can call it that came out on Ellen was that this would pretty much be the last interview that Jesus Compost would do. And evidently, the same thing goes for the Las Vegas PD, who've decided they've had it with answering questions from pesky press that just won't buy the official story and go away. Now they're being told, go away anyway. You can rest assured that eventually, Facebook will direct them to the only answers they're going to be allowed to hear. Oh, and a quick P.S. here. Your host is still willing to bet that, at least for now, if enough Americans speak up and say, I'm not swallowing this B.S., there may still be more, information eventually forthcoming. Why, if we're squeaky wheel enough, why, if enough people complain, maybe even a doctored video, eventually. And a Hollywood movie, for sure. Wonder if they'll let Harvey Weinstein produce it. I can't help but think he might be more credible than the FBI. Yeah, and that brings me to a quick story via theduran.com about one of the original American conspiracy theories, the execution of a sitting president, and the cover-up, known variously as the Warren Report, or if you prefer, the magic bullet, and the fact that at least once upon a time, after years and years and years of obfuscation, some documents were supposed to come out real soon now, like end of October timeframe, 2017. Here's the story. More than 3,000 never-before-seen documents from the FBI, the CIA, and the Department of Just Us on the execution of John F. Kennedy are scheduled to be released pretty much within the month. With many experts, though, are you sitting down, fearing that such a large release of secret JFK assassination documents will spur, especially if they haven't been properly redacted and sanitized, you can rest assured. But, I mean, really, it's not like they haven't had plenty of time. Quote, a new generation of conspiracy theories. So guess what, folks? According to insider Roger Stone, the CIA is urging President Donald Trump to do what we're getting so used to seeing done, to cave, to obfuscate, and to basically say, no, you don't have a right to know. In other words, to additionally delay disclosing some of the files for, oh, another quarter century or so. Says Roger Stone in a post on his website, and we could probably guess this, quote, they must reflect badly on the CIA, even though virtually everyone involved is long dead, unquote. I guess the problem is they would reflect badly on things that, while the original perps are long dead, are still, very clearly, going on. I guess the real problem is people might start saying, hey, you know, the Bible was right all along. When it comes to corruption, bribery, racketeering, and, of course, covering it all up with murder, there really is nothing new under the sun. And to a very great extent, that applies to the bombshell story of the week as well. You've heard it here, but the waste stream still doesn't want to talk about it. Here's the headline of the story from Allison Spann and John Solomon at TheHill.com, which at least begins to connect a few of the dots that have been out there waiting for, as it turns out, about 7 years now. Obama administration approved controversial nuclear deal with Moscow. And the story begins that before the Obama regime approved that controversial deal all the way back in 2010, giving Moscow control of a large swath, about 20%, other stories have been telling us for years now, of the entire American uranium and yellow cake output, the FBI had, get this, gathered substantial evidence that Russian nuclear industry officials were engaged in, well, let's just say stuff that if Donald Trump had done them, would be front page news. Bribery, kickbacks, extortion, and money laundering designed to grow Vladimir Putin's atomic energy business inside the United States, according to government documents and interviews. Federal agents used a confidential U.S. witness working inside the Russian nuclear industry to gather extensive financial records, make secret recordings, and intercept emails. Some of them, you can probably guess, were Hillary's. As far back as 2009, they showed Moscow had compromised an American uranium trucking firm with bribes and kickbacks in violation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, according to FBI and court documents. And I guess at this point, people like James Comey and Robert Mueller and other high-level officials in the FBI are asking themselves, hey, where's that bleach bid program when you really need it? I guess that's the problem with still having a few honest agents left in the Bureau. The Hill also says these folks obtained an eyewitness account backed by documents indicating that Russian nuclear officials had routed millions of dollars to the U.S. designed to benefit, are you sitting down, former President Bill Clinton's charitable foundation, the infamous Clinton Foundation, during the time that Secretary of State, you know her name, Hillary Clinton, served on a government body that provided a favorable decision to Moscow. Said sources to The Hill. The racketeering scheme was conducted, quote, with the consent of higher-level officials in Russia, who shared the proceeds from the kickbacks, declared one agent in an affidavit years later. And here's possibly the key paragraph in the piece, folks. Rather than bring immediate charges back in 2010, yep, 7 years ago, the Just Us Department continued to investigate, you're going to love this term, the matter for nearly 4 more years, essentially leaving the American public and Congress, but they're used to it, in the dark about major Russian nuclear corruption on U.S. soil during a period when the Obama regime made 2 major decisions benefiting Putin's commercial nuclear ambitions. The first was in October of 2010, when the Hitlery State Department and government agencies on the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S. unanimously approved the partial sale of Canadian mining company Uranium One to the Russian nuclear giant Rosatom, giving Moscow control of more than 20% of America's uranium supply. That, of course, was subsequently poo-pooed on the campaign trail by the woman who would be king, and who did make a whole lot of money from the Russian connection. The real Russian connection, Hitlery. And that was followed up in 2011 by the administration giving approval to Rosatom's Tenex subsidiary to sell commercial uranium to U.S. nuclear power plants via a partnership arrangement. Quote, the Russians were compromising American contractors in the nuclear industry with kickbacks and extortion threats, all of which raised legitimate national security concerns. And none of that evidence got aired before the Obama administration made those decisions, unquote, said a person who worked on the case to The Hill, speaking, of course, on condition of anonymity for fear of Can you imagine this in America? Retribution by U.S. or Russian officials. Arguably because the bad guys still clearly have lots of swamp critters, friends in high places. Names like Robert Mueller, James Comey, and of course, Hitler's dead list spring to mind. Here I pause for a bit of background, knowing that some of you are probably new to this show, and if you've been listening to, CNN, or MSNBC, or PBS, or most of the waste stream, you probably haven't heard a word about this. In January 2013, Russian newspaper Pravda celebrated their Atomic Energy Agency's purchase of Uranium-1 in Canada, and because Uranium-1 was in part owned by concessions in the United States, and uranium is a strategically important commodity, the Russians knew they'd need approval from the Obama regime, including the Hillary-Clinton State Department, before the purchase would be allowed. And 9 shareholders in Uranium One just happened, what an amazing coincidence, to provide more than $145 million in donations. What a quaint word in this case. Quid pro quo is the Latin term that might be appropriate, because bribe sounds kind of crass, to the Clinton Foundation in the run-up to that State Department approval. Yes, the Clintons took the cash from Uranium One officials before the deal was approved by the Hillary Clinton State Department, and they hid them. Which, say those stories that actually covered the scam, is a clear violation of the MOU that Ms. Clinton signed before she took her office. And it was in 2015 when author Peter Schweitzer in the New York Times, yeah, you heard me right, actually documented how Bill Clinton collected hundreds of thousands of dollars in Russian speaking fees, and his charitable foundation collected literally millions in donations from parties interested in the deal, while Hitler presided on the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. Last summer, by the way, Peter Schweitzer released a feature film documentary entitled Clinton Cash, providing a whole lot more detail. But in 2015, the Times reported, quote, as the Russians gradually assumed control of Uranium 1 in 3 separate transactions between 2009 to 2013, Canadian records show, a flow of cash made its way to the Clinton Foundation. Uranium 1's chairman used his family foundation to make 4 donations, totaling $2.35 million. Those contributions were not publicly disclosed by the Clintons, despite an agreement Mrs. Clinton had struck with the Obama White House. That, your host interjects here, is the so-called Memorandum of Understanding to publicly identify all donors. Other people with ties to the company made donations as well, unquote. And then there's this, where Senator John Barrasso, Republican of Wyoming, told Greta Van Susteren of the deal that Hitler gave to Vladimir, including 20% of U.S. uranium. And Barrasso added that Russia sells uranium to unfriendly countries, notably including Iran. And maybe that sheds a bit more light on the Obama-Iran deal at this point as well. Hitler, of course, among many other things, was never questioned about her involvement with Russia, even though 1 part in 5 of U.S. uranium was sold to Russia under her watchful eyes. Donald Trump brought up the uranium deal many times during the election season and earlier this year after becoming president. Hitler, of course, continues to deny any wrongdoing, and once again, Trump was right. And if we have time, we'll get back to some related aspects on that front here in a few minutes. The story from The Hill picks up at this point and tells us that the Obama regime and the Clintons defended their actions at the time, insisting there was no evidence that any Russians or donors engaged in wrongdoing, and that there was, I love this part, no national security reason, and hey, aren't they the experts, for any member of the committee to oppose the Uranium One deal. Did y'all cash your checks? But the FBI, the Energy Department, and court documents revealed to The Hill that the FBI had, in fact, gathered substantial evidence well before the committee's decision that a fellow named Vadim Makarin, the main Russian overseeing Putin's nuclear expansion inside the United States, was, in fact, engaged in wrongdoing starting as far back as 2009. And that's not all. Then Attorney General, Mr. Fast and Furious himself, paragon of virtue, Eric Holder, was among the Obama regime officials joining Hitler in the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States at the time the Uranium One deal was approved. Multiple current and former officials have told The Hill that they did not know whether the FBI or DOJ ever alerted committee members to the criminal activity that they had uncovered. In other words, folks, those that weren't on the take on the committee were ignorant about just how deep the rabbit hole went. Says The Hill, spokesmen for Holder and Clinton didn't return calls seeking comment. Neither did the Department of Just Us. There's a whole lot more in the story here about Makarin. Basically, he was a director of Rosatom's 10X unit in Moscow since the early 2000s. Then he got to be part of this particular scam. In affidavits from 2014 and 2015, an Energy Department agent assigned to assist the FBI testified that Makarin supervised a, quote, racketeering scheme that involved extortion, bribery, money laundering, and kickbacks that were both directed by and provided benefit to more senior officials back in Russia. Do you think maybe Robert Mueller has their names? There's a lot more detail here on the specifics, but the part that kind of caught my eye, folks, was that the investigation, gotta say the word sick after that, don't I, was ultimately supervised by then U.S. Attorney Rod Rosenstein, an Obama official who now serves as President Trump's Deputy Attorney General. Obviously, that part of the swamp hasn't yet been drained, but it does explain a lot. And furthermore, then Assistant FBI Director Andrew McCabe, now, still, unfortunately, deputy director under Trump. And evidently knee-deep in Vegas, too. What an amazing coincidence. Call it a continuing stench. When it comes to Makarin, however, the plot continues to thicken. Because eventually, the claim is, at least, the man was brought to justice. Listen to how The Hill reports this part. Bringing down a major Russian nuclear corruption scheme that had both compromised a sensitive uranium transportation asset inside the United States, that's a whole other lengthy part of the story, and that had facilitated international money laundering, you would think would be a major feather in any law enforcement agency's cap. Why then did they keep it a secret? Turns out both the Justice Department and the FBI took little credit in 2014 when Makarin, Russian financier, and trucking firm executives were all arrested and charged. The only public statement occurred a full year later when the Department of Justice put out a very little notice press release just days before Labor Day. Ain't that the standard operating procedure? August of 2015, which noted that the various defendants had reached plea deals. By that time, the criminal cases against Makarin had been narrowed to a single charge of money laundering for a scheme that officials admitted stretched from the years 2004 through 2014. And although agents had evidence for criminal wrongdoing they collected at least since 2009, federal prosecutors in the plea agreement only cited a handful of transactions occurring in the years 2011 and 2012, well after the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States had given their approval to, you know what. Almost, folks, like they don't want to draw attention to something that was clearly intended to go away. The final court case also made no mention at all of any connection to the influence-peddling conversations that the FBI undercover informant had witnessed about Russian nuclear officials trying to ingratiate themselves with the Clintons, even though agents had gathered documents showing the transmission of millions of dollars from Russia's nuclear industry to an American entity that had provided assistance to the Clinton Foundation, said sources to The Hill. The lack of fanfare, to put it mildly, kept many key players in Washington ignorant. They had no inkling that a major nuclear corruption scheme with serious national security implications had been uncovered. And likewise, major congressional figures were also kept in the dark. Is it beginning to become clear why, folks? This week, the Senate Mushrooms did decide, hey, maybe they'd better look into the bribery, extortion, and racketeering involved with the Clinton Foundation and all the criminals here that are still running the swamp. Says The Hill, the Senate Judiciary Committee has launched a full-scale probe into the Russian nuclear bribery case, demanding to know what federal agencies knew and when they knew it. But hey, remember that informant who helped to break the case? Don't expect his testimony, because his lawyer has said that, quote, the Obama Justice Department threatened him with a loss of freedom and said they'd bring a criminal case against him for violating his employment nondisclosure agreement. That may not fly. Remember, Eric Holder just told him, go pound salt. When it comes to witnesses, I bet there are people on the Clinton dead list who wish they could testify. We'll be right back. Home of the free. You better wake up. Get ready to rumble, put all the guns on. We're killing our babies before they are born. Stand up and be kind and come and sound the alarm. Are you one of God's children, but nothing but the devil's hound? Whose side are you on? welcome back to the second segment of the show for this evening. Again, this is your host, Mark Hall, and we're talking about a whole bunch of things this week that make the same point, seems like the news has for quite a while now. When it comes to various three-letter agencies, people who put their hands on the Bible and lie through their teeth, if their lips are moving, yeah, they're still lying. And it turns out there is nothing new under the sun on that score. It goes back at least as far as the assassination and cover-up of JFK, but there have been lots and lots of other examples in the interim. Meanwhile, the press has been working hard to try to convince us that nothing else matters unless it comes from Hollywood. And of course, when it comes to scandal, oh yeah, they've got a really old one. It's as old as the casting couch in Hollywood to trot out again, as if Hollywood and just about everybody else that's been watching what's been going on there didn't realize that the place is riddled with scumbags, including, of course, Harvey Weinstein. But he kind of fits right in, doesn't he? I saw at least one producer came out later in the week and said, come on, we all effing knew about this. Who are we kidding? But it's not Uranium One, and it's not the Las Vegas cover-up. Heck, it's not even the NFL atrocity. So they seem to want to run with it. So I do a little bit of compare and contrast and think, hey, the way things are going, let's consider this as a likely future headline. Robert Mueller names Harvey Weinstein to head Blue Ribbon Panel investigating allegations of sexual impropriety by President Donald Trump. Former President Bill Clinton to testify. For the last word on this aspect of evil, I turn next to Judge Jeanine. The opening monologue for her show, which went into some detail on this sordid story over the weekend, was downright brilliant and blunt.
Don't you love it when those so-called social justice warriors, the ones who claim moral and ethical superiority over the rest of us, the ones who chastise us because of our core American values, are hoisted on their own petard? This week, a real blockbuster as the curtain goes up on those Trump-hating, Soros-loving, socialist, condescending Hollywood glitterati for their silence, acceptance, and cover-up of one of their own, serial super-sexual predator Harvey Weinstein.
And better still, once she gets rolling, she really nails it.
Weinstein, once a famous, now infamous movie maker, accused of at least three rapes and continuing sexual assault and harassment of dozens of young women on two continents, silencing those around him with his ability to intimidate victims, pressure business associates, and buy powerful Democrats. Gee, another intersection of crime, money, power, and the Democrat Party.
And here I do have to pause just for a second and interject, probably an obvious commentary, but imagine, folks, if he had the power of, say, a Bill or Hillary Clinton, not to mention a bimbo eruption squad of his own that was able to keep the media cowed, he'd probably still be getting away with all of this. Why, who knows? If he had a dead list of his own, he might have even been able to run for president. There is one other difference I guess we need to bear in mind. Hitler took money in exchange for favors. Weinstein thought he should be on the other side of that equation, it would seem.
Weinstein gave hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Democrat Party. Nonstop donations to Hillary Clinton.
And as she points out, lots more beyond that, too.
And Hillary, the woman who created her own war room to destroy the women who accused her husband Bill of rape and sexual assault, hides for 5 days before saying she's shocked.
And the good judge points out, too bad Hillary wasn't elected. She could have pardoned criminals like this, just like her hubby did, if that was even necessary. After all, look what she got away with the DOJ and FBI. And may still be happening, come to think of it. And Judge Jeanine Pirro draws the connection between hypocrisy and Hitlery in a pretty severe fashion. Why, she's even got Meryl Streep beat by pointing out this recent interview, courtesy of the BBC. Yeah, she notes Hitlery did feel compelled to say this offshore. And you have to listen carefully, because she would seem to be talking about Trump. And not only not Harvey Weinstein, but not even the guy that she knew darn well was the worst sexual predator, arguably, ever to step through the doors of the Oval Office.
While we have someone admitting to being a sexual assaulter in the Oval Office, there has to be a recognition that we must stand against this kind of, action that is so sexist and misogynistic.
unless obviously it butters our political bread, in which case we will cover it up, lie about it, and kill if necessary to make sure it stays that way. The judge wasn't happy with the hypocrisy either.
You know, Hillary, now that I think of it, both you and Harvey are a lot alike. Both of you addicted to a drug. Both of you love power, money, and domination. Weinstein wants to dominate Hollywood, and you want to dominate Washington.
Okay, well, she pulled her punch there, admittedly. No, she doesn't just want to dominate Washington, folks, and we all know that. Judge Jeanine also pointed out, of course, that Weinstein wasn't done just giving money to high-profile Democrats and criminals like Hill and Bill. He was big on giving money, at least $700,000 that we know of, to the Sotero-Sabarco-Obama crime family, too. And that evidently bought a few days of silence from the camp of the Obama hypocrites as well. Sometimes, admittedly, it's hard to know which Hollywood admires more. Progressive, leftist, outright criminal crime family politics, or their own self-serving hypocrisy, especially when it lines their pockets. I remembered the following really disgusting quote from Robert De Niro. A bit of sour grapes after his preferred godfather didn't manage to pull off the intended coup, on the original schedule anyway. When it comes to hypocrisy, this was worth saving in the archives. And no, he's not talking about Harvey Weinstein here. He's been strangely, even uncharacteristically, quiet on that score. He's talking about President Trump.
He's a punk, he's a dog, he's a pig, he's a con, a bullshit artist, a mutt, thinks he's gaming society. Well, I'd like to punch him in the face.
It seems there's no shortage of male hypocrisy in Hollywood either. Judge Jeanine seems to suggest it may have something to do with money, Bob. And I thought it was a really nice touch. While she was running her comments on this particular hypocrite from Hollywood, she scrolled through an entire list of the De Niro pocket-lining films that featured a prominent association with the same sexual predator, Harvey Weinstein, that De Niro doesn't evidently want to punch in the face.
Bob, how many of his movies have lined your bank account?
Answer, a couple of screenfuls. And the list of titles make it clear that not only is it obvious why Robert De Niro is silent when it comes to really nasty predator punks, but arguably knew or should have known who he was, in bed with. And Judge Jeanine's conclusion, too, is something that I pretty much can't argue with in the least.
Folks, Hollywood's been steeped in hypocrisy for decades. As the curtain goes up on the casting couch, aka the casting bed, the town that glorifies violence, murder, and rape is the same town where centuries-old rules of women sleeping for a job is kept quiet. Actors, the ones who need to read other people's words for a living and then convince themselves that they have the moral turpitude to pontificate to the rest of us on how we should act, try to tell us how to be. And by the way, it's not over yet, folks. There's more coming. It's not just adult women. It's human trafficking. It's child sex trafficking. It's real pedophilia.
And that, in fact, is probably the real story here, as well as the reason why the distraction is getting so much front page coverage, while what is intended to be distracted from is still hidden, at least for now. And we follow that story up with a piece from Daniel Horowitz at theconservativereview.com about rogue judges, whom, he notes, can certainly undermine our sovereignty, and we shouldn't put up with it. Horowitz is writing basically about the invasion of large numbers of foreign nationals and how the intent here is to undermine national sovereignty and literally destroy what's left of the rule of law. That is certainly a key aspect of all of this, but he also points out within the article another element that I wanted to focus on perhaps a bit more, especially in the context of where we are today. It starts this way. Judge James Robart of the Western District of Washington issued a temporary injunction nationwide on almost the entire Trump executive order. Now, this has been around for a while. I've talked about it on this news show. That means, of course, that any refugee from any country or visa holder from the 7 countries that were once excluded now must be let into the U.S., at least that's the claim, even if they're standing outside our border. And yes, he notes words can't describe just how radical this opinion is. For a number of reasons. For one, who is this guy? Why does he think he has executive power that exceeds the elected president? Furthermore, he's in the Western District of Washington. And where the blankety-blankin' you-know-what does he get off having the alleged authority to make a decision for the entire country? How about other district judges who have ruled in accord with the law in other places? In other words, why does one guy who gets it wrong overrule not only the president, but a whole bunch of other judges who made the opposite ruling for their places? Do you see how absolutely insane this is? And for crying out loud, who decides who it is who decides? Answer, it's not the president, it's obviously not the Congress, and it doesn't seem to be any particular judge. It's just evidently some judge that makes the right decision in a case that somebody who the real decider happens to be agrees with. The question is, who is that real decider? As if we didn't know that somewhere down the line, it's the swamp critters in the deep state. Let me come at this again without spending an hour citing precedents. You have court after court that rules for our jurisdiction. Here is the way we're interpreting some statute, hopefully actually in accord with the written law about it, whatever it might be. And now you have one court in one place, the term judge shopping comes to mind, that rules the opposite and furthermore claims my decision because, well, I guess just because, now applies to the whole country, whether I have jurisdiction or not. And you know what's funny? People actually think that somehow matters. As opposed to deciding the guy is a nutcase who's operating outside of his jurisdiction, and why is anybody paying attention to him at all? Used to be called an impeachable offense. And, of course, everything about this idiotic judge's order literally runs contrary to the written statute, which explicitly authorizes the presidential authority for Trump to do precisely what he did. And furthermore, as Horowitz writes, by issuing the ruling, Judge Robart and a couple of other idiots that tried to do the same thing are not only overturning Trump's authority and executive order, but they're also saying that even if Congress were to pass a similar law, they have pre-declared that to be unconstitutional. And it's particularly nice if you can do that without citing any constitutional authority for the claim. Because indeed, the exact opposite is the case. As Thomas Jefferson once said, when it comes to establishing who's the final arbiter of the Constitution itself has erected no such single tribunal. And if it ain't the Supreme Court, as Jefferson was pointing out, it sure is blankety-blankin' you-know-what isn't the Western District of Washington, or any other second- or third-tier wannabes. Daniel Horowitz points out that he wrote a book entitled Stolen Sovereignty that warned that if Congress fails to strip the courts of their so-called jurisdiction over immigration, radical judges, like we've now seen, will give affirmative immigration rights to foreign nationals and literally destroy what's left of national sovereignty. Congress explicitly has this power, under Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution, to strip lower courts, and indeed the Supreme Court if they wanted to, like, say, for abortion. But they pointedly refused to even consider that, obviously, because it would solve the problem and remove a great congressional fundraising tool. Well, in that area and many others, including this one, when it comes to all of these issues of jurisdiction with regard to illegal immigrants and foreign nationals. And here he returns to this concept of judge shopping, saying what we're seeing encourages exactly that, where judges assert tyrannical authority over the congressional and executive branches, and these, again, are second- or third-tier wannabes, that a puny district judge created by Congress can get away with this pretty well demonstrates we've reached the final frontier in judicial tyranny. And this means, he writes, that if the courts are not stripped of their ill-gotten and actually non-existent so-called jurisdiction over immigration, the ACLU and the far left will be able to shop around for any number of extremely liberal judges to place national injunctions on any act of enforcement, whether it's illegal or legal immigration or, pretty soon, anything else that they might want. No matter how many other courts in different jurisdictions say otherwise, we'll just point to the one we want and ignore any adverse ruling. Isn't that cute? And again, who gets to decide? Unless ultimately, as we've noted before, it ends up being decided by force of arms when people decide they've had enough. Oh, and I'll interject it again here. Can you see why the Islamic invasion and the attempt to undermine the rule of law by force of numbers, while at the same time attempting to undermine it from the other side, by stripping the American people of their right to keep and bear arms so that they can be overwhelmed from below, all fit together. All of this ignores American history, law, and tradition, writes Horowitz, which is, of course, true. But you know what, folks? Your host will contend that is precisely the intent. We've talked about a lot of deception this week. Why don't we wrap it up with old science? This comes from Roddy Anada via Global Research, and it's entitled Planetary Weapons and Military Weather Modification. Yeah, whether you call them chemtrails, atmospheric geoengineering, or environmental warfare, we're talking about the same old science. And in this context, I'm not talking about anthropogenic global warming, a.k.a. taxpayer-paid pseudoscience or even bribery. Take your pick. The story starts this way. Developed in 1988 by the United Nations Environmental Program and the UN's World Meteorological Organization, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, yes, the infamous IPCC, maintains its silence on military weather modification applications, which continue to skew the data that they claim to be driven by. What are called extreme weather and climate events are linked to climate change, although they make no mention of government programs that deliberately aim at modifying the weather and inducing earthquakes, drought, rain, and even tsunamis. The weather modification program, at least when it comes to the U.S. version, is at least 70 years old. Public service announcements printed in newspapers way back in the 1960s warned of government intention to modify the weather. Remember Life magazine? Back in the 50s and 60s, they continually covered U.S. weather modification programs, including something called Project Storm Fury, which redirected and reduced, are you sitting down, hurricane intensity. Between 1962 and 1983, and the IPCC's continuing and absolute silence on such programs, says the author, is deafening. With insider knowledge, a chapter in the 1968 book called Unless Peace Comes, A Scientific Forecast of New Weapons, predicted the development of technologies that would use the planet itself as a weapon. In a chapter entitled How to Wreck the Environment, penned by geophysicist and member of President Johnson's Science Advisory Committee, Dr. Gordon J.F. McDonald, he stated the following. The key to geophysical warfare is the identification of environmental instabilities, to which the addition of a small amount of energy would release vastly greater amounts of energy, unquote. And folks, this phenomenon is well known to science and engineering in just about every field you can imagine. If you observe something that's getting ready to fall over or break, sometimes one little push in the right direction is all it takes. Matter of fact, it's well known to grade school girls. If you want the kid in the swing to go higher, you push at the right time, when she's already going the direction you want, and a little bit of extra energy helps make a big difference. McDonald's chapter envisions four planetary weapons, which he predicted would be fully developed by now, in other words, the early 21st century, based on the state of then-current research. They are climate modification, earthquake generation, and your host can remember decades ago having read biographies of the great scientist and inventor Nikola Tesla, where he talked about a device he built that was able to do that over 100 years ago. Back to the list, tsunami generation and direction, and even mass behavior control via electromagnetic manipulation of the ionosphere. And this was back in the early days of something that you may have heard of called HARP, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project. That was new in those days, your host remembers, as a young ham radio operator in the 1970s. Something hams called the Russian woodpecker that messed up our shortwave communications. Turns out there was an American version of the same thing, too. And they lied to us about what they were intended to do. Imagine that. In 1996, world-renowned scientist Dr. Rosalie Bertell wrote the following. It would be rash to assume that HARP is an isolated experiment which would not be expanded. It's related to 50 years of intensive and increasingly destructive programs to understand and control the upper atmosphere. It would be rash not to associate HARP with the space laboratory construction, which is separately being planned by the United States. HARP is an integral part of a long history of space research and development of a deliberately military nature, unquote. As LBJ's science advisor, McDonald surely knew of the nation's military weather modification program called Operation Popeye, which ran between 1967 and 72. in places like Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. By seeding clouds, the U.S. military was able to cause torrential downpours that inhibited enemy truck and troop movements. The program was initially exposed by investigative journalist Jack Anderson, and the existence of the project was later corroborated in the Pentagon Papers. In the year 2000, Dr. Bertel told the Times of London that U.S. military scientists are working on weather systems as a potential weapon. The methods include the enhancing of storms and the diverting of water rivers in the Earth's atmosphere to produce targeted droughts or floods. In a book called Angels Don't Play This Harp, Dr. Nick Begich explained that harp could also trigger earthquakes and volcanoes. To that end, he quotes Clinton's Secretary of Defense, William S. Cohen, who said in 1997 at a conference on terrorism, quote, "Others are engaging even in an echo type of terrorism whereby they can alter the climate, set off earthquakes, volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves," unquote. Pragmatically, observed Begich, the U.S. wouldn't be worried about such weapons unless they knew themselves that they were feasible and at least the likelihood had already been developed. Which brings us to chemtrails, now more correctly called atmospheric geoengineering. You may have seen any number of articles over the last few years on the subject, from photographs that have been taken by people literally worldwide to more detailed articles on places like Dane Wigington's Geoengineering Watch. The same goes for a number of U.S. patents issued specifically in the fields of climate control and weather modification. Says Global Research, as they publish several pages of pictures on the phenomenon, you can find a partial list of those patents for stratospheric aerial spraying programs between 1917 through the early part of the new century. Take a look at Lori Kramer's Patently Obvious, A Partial History of Aerosol and Weather-Related Technologies, or also the book Weather Warfare by Jerry Smith, which has an appendix of HARP-related patents on the topic. Bottom line seems to be that in spite of claims about what's been added to jet fuel, Jet A, at one time anyway, not too different from diesel fuel for trucks, it's basically kerosene with additives primarily, at least supposedly intended, to prevent the fuel from congealing at high altitudes and low temperatures. But one thing's for sure, folks, if you understand the physics involved, there's a big difference between contrails, condensation trails caused by water vapor in jet exhaust, which can condense into clouds when the conditions for cloud formation are at hand, and something different and much more persistent, well, geoengineering evidence. We can't call them chemtrails anymore, I guess, because if you do, you're a conspiracy theorist. After a look at recent stories, contracts, and corporate involvement, you know, the old story, who benefits, quo bene, the author concludes by saying, look, how easy would it be for a nation with decades of experience in modifying the weather and in triggering geophysical events to create the problem of climate change, or exaggerate its significance, in order to induce the world into approving or even demanding geoengineering to fix the problem they can create? With decades of patents proving the history of capabilities, could this entire drama, ask Global Research, including extreme weather events, be orchestrated in the simple pursuit of profit, or perhaps control? Isn't this precisely what the Hegelian dialectic is all about anyway? Problem, reaction, solution, or thesis, antithesis, synthesis. In other words, those in a position of power invent the problem, anticipate the public reaction to it, and even push at the right time in the right direction in order to use that reaction to generate demand for the very solution which was intended all along. At the very least, while the veil may be lifting on geoengineering practices, there's still an apparent effort to conceal the extent to which the planet is already being geoengineered. And to that, all I can add is, hey, why not, folks? If we've been paying attention, it's pretty clear they're lying about darn near everything else, especially when it comes to things intended to control, dominate, and, to some extent, destroy just about everything we once held dear. I believe it's time to make sure we understand who we serve.